What's up, everyone? I'm Em.
And I'm Nick.
And welcome in to the Ominous Archives. So, welcome into the archives.
Yeah.
It is episode 2 of spooky season.
Woo! Hopefully everybody enjoyed episode 1.
Yes, it is the best time of the year. It's my favorite time of the year.
It's everybody's favorite time of the year. We're going to say that until we finish.
I'm going to say it until I'm orange in the face.
And I just realized last week that you get 5 episodes of spooky season.
Ha ha! Look at me. Lucky me.
Yeah. Lucky everybody. You get 5. All culminating in our on-site recording.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So, today, I thought I would do something a little different. I feel like it's not something that, like, I feel like we would typically, like, touch on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a story that I've known for as long as I can remember, and I'm almost positive if you're listening to this type of podcast that I'm sure at some point in your life, you've heard the words, Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. And when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41.
Oh, so we are covering axes.
Yeah, actually, cat's out of the bag, we're covering axes.
Ah, cool. Like throwing axes, yeah, chopping axes.
I'm an expert.
Oh.
Actually, the Bordens only received 29 whacks, not the 81 that were suggested by the famous rhyme.
29 total?
Yeah.
29, okay.
29 total between the two of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the popularity of the poem is a testament to the public's fascination with the 1893 murder trial of Lizzie Borden.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
1893.
Right?
And we're still fascinated with it.
Yeah. I'm still talking about it. Like I said.
Well, I hope so. It's your topic this week.
Yeah, it would be funny. That's it. We're cutting it. We're done.
That's it. We're done.
We talked about axes and her name and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, before I start, I know we aren't technically a true crime podcast, so to say, so I am just going to give a little bit of a trigger warning on this one. I am going to be talking about death and murder, and if that's not something that you enjoy listening to, it's not something that we typically, like, spend a lot of time on, but it's kind of the whole preface of this episode today,
yeah,
so I feel like I have to...
Typically, it's in order to have true crime, somebody's kind of got to die.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I mean, I guess they don't. You could have a robbery, but...
True. You could.
Yeah.
But for all intents and purposes, I am talking about death here. So.
Okay.
So to start us off, I'm going to take us back to that night of the crime. On a hot August 4th, 1892, at 92 2nd Street in Fall River, Massachusetts, Bridget, whose nickname was Maggie, I feel like I refer to her more as Maggie sometimes, so I feel like if you get confused between the Bridget and Maggie, they're the same person. The maid in the Borden family residence laid in her bed just after having washed the outside windows. She heard the bell at City Hall ring and looked at her clock. It was 11 o'clock on the dot. When all of a sudden, she hears a cry from Lizzie Borden, who is the younger of the two Borden daughters. She says, quote, Maggie, come down quick, father's dead, and someone came in and killed him. It's very, very blunt right off the bat.
Yeah.
A half hour or so later, after the body of Andrew Borden, that had been, quote, hacked almost beyond recognition, had been covered, and the downstairs was searched by police for evidence of an intruder. A neighbor, who had come to comfort Lizzie, named Adeline Churchill, made a chilling discovery on the second floor of the Borden home. The body of Abby Borden, Lizzie's stepmother. Investigators found Abby's body cold, while Andrew's had been discovered warm, indicating that Abby was killed earlier, probably at least 90 minutes earlier than her husband.
So there's about an hour and a half between the two murders.
Yeah, and it's, like, visible. Like, he was warm, she was cold. Like, that's not a mistake. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, I mean, in that heat,
does
too.
Does not lie.
She's, like, she's cooler.
Right. Quote, shocking crime. A venerable citizen and his aged wife hacked to pieces in their home, was the headline the Fall River Herald reported. And the news of the Borden murders spread like wildfire. And hundreds poured into Second Street, where for years Andrew J. Borden and his wife had lived in happiness. The Herald reporter who visited the crime scene described the face of the dead man as sickening. He said, trigger warning, his face was hacked to pieces and the blood had covered the man's shirt to the point where he would have thought that the shirt was that color.
Ugh.
Yeah.
And I wonder, too, back then, I would think, like, shirts didn't have... I don't know if shirts were actually colored or anything like that.
I don't know.
Maybe it was, like, a tan or a white.
Yeah, well...
And now it's red?
Now it's red or, like...
Brown.
I was going to say blood gets, like, dark when it sits for a while.
Yeah, like a brownish.
Right. However, despite all of that gore, the room was in order and there was no signs of a scuffle of any kind. Initial speculation on the identity of the murderer centered on a Portuguese laborer who had visited the Borden home earlier in the morning and, quote, asked for money that they owed him, only to be told by Andrew Borden that he had no money and to come back later. The story added that medical evidence suggested that Abby Borden was killed by a tall man who struck the woman from behind. 2 days after the murder, papers began reporting evidence that 33-year-old Lizzie Borden might have had something to do with her parents' murders. Most significantly, Eli Bence, who was a clerk at S.R. Smith's drugstore in Fall River, told police that Lizzie visited the store the day before the murder and attempted to purchase prussic acid, which is a deadly poison. Another story in the Boston Daily Globe reported rumors that Lizzie and her stepmother never really got along together peacefully, and that for a considerable time they hadn't even spoken, but noted also that family members insisted that the relationship between the two women were quite normal. The Boston Herald, meanwhile, viewed Lizzie as suspicious. From the consensus of opinion, it can be said in Lizzie Borden's life, there is not one single deliberately unkind act. Police came to the conclusion that the murders must have been committed by someone within the Borden home, but were puzzled by the lack of blood anywhere except on the bodies of the victims and their inability to uncover any obvious murder weapon.
I think that's crazy.
Yeah.
The lack of blood.
Mm-hmm.
If you got whacked in the head...
It's such a gruesome, sickening scene and discovery. Like, the bodies are completely...
I mean...
And the rest of the scene is just, like, fine and normal.
I don't know
police No signs work. Of a struggle, like, at all? Like,
well, I mean, you get whacked in the head.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, if you're not expecting it.
Mm-hmm.
But I still can't see that being, like, a clean-cut, done deal. Like, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I feel like there'd be evidence.
I would think, like, across the room, there would have to be some kind of, like, blood trails or something like that. Like, there's no way you just get hacked in the head and there's not blood everywhere.
Right. So, increasingly, suspicion turned towards Lizzie, since her older sister, Emma, was out of the home at the time of the murders and had an airtight alibi. Investigators found it strange that Lizzie knew so little of her mother's whereabouts after 9 a.m. when, according to Lizzie, she had gone upstairs to put shams on the pillows.
How long does it take to put a sham on a pillow? I mean, some pillowcases take me forever.
True.
Or maybe it's just me, but they take a lot.
They also found odd in her story that during the 15 minutes in which Andrew Borden was murdered in the living room, Lizzie was out in the backyard barn looking for irons for an upcoming fishing trip. How convenient. Like, you just happened to not be in that. You were just looking for something. Like, I don't know. Let me clarify. I'm giving her the benefit of the doubt. I'm not a Lizzie Borden, like, you know.
She did it.
Right. I feel like I'm giving you all this to form an opinion. You don't have to agree with mine.
Yeah, I mean, part of me feels like I could see it.
Right.
Like.
Yeah. But, like, I don't know. I feel like it's random and very convenient.
Mm-hmm.
The barn loft where she said she was looking revealed no footprints on the dusty floor. And in the heat of the middle of the summer, the loft seemed likely to disencourage anyone from spending more than a few minutes searching for equipment that wouldn't be used for days. That was the other thing. Like, this fishing trip wasn't tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just happened to be, like, at that very second in time. I don't know.
I mean, I pack for vacations at least a week ahead of time.
This is true. True.
Like, I'll have all my stuff together. I'll use a new deodorant at my house
and
have mine packed.
Right.
Like, call me crazy, call me whatever. I just, you know.
You're a very type A personality. You are very, like, I feel as though that is happening more.
Yeah, I have to try and get it. Like, my ducks have to go in a row. Even though the one always wanders off.
Yeah, they have to be there. I have to think they're in a row.
They have to make me just give me the optical illusion. Right. They look like they're in a row and I'm okay.
Theories about a tall male intruder were reconsidered, and one leading physician explained that hacking is almost a positive sign of a deed by a woman who is unconscious of what she is doing. That's the other thing with this whole, like, the nature of the crime. how much, how hard it is to, first of all, just stab somebody alone, let alone, like, with, like, a regular just, like, knife, the amount of, with a whole, like, axe, like, that's gonna take a lot of force, a lot of anger, so I feel like it's got it, like, it's personal to me, like, it feels like it's the personal type of crime. Also, you're gonna be tired, like, that takes a lot out of you.
Have you ever chopped a block of wood with an axe?
Can't say I have.
Yeah, try it.
Yeah, I can imagine. It would take all of my energy.
And how many times the axe gets stuck?
Yeah, true.
It's not just like a one shot. Ding, yeah. And then you can just pull it, like, I've never at least had it where you chop it and it comes right back out.
Oh, I don't like to think about that. So on August 9th, so now 5 days after the murder, an inquest into the Borden murders was held in the courtroom over police headquarters. Criminal magistrate Josiah Blaisdell and district attorney Hosea Knowlton questioned Lizzie Borden, Brendan Sullivan, and house guest John Moores, and others during her four-hour examination. Changing her name now.
There you are.
Lizzie gave confused and contradictory answers. 2 days later, the inquest adjourned, and Police Chief Hillard arrested Lizzie Borden.
In 5 days.
Yeah, they said.
I feel like it's kind of a long time for, if they were going to say it's her. You know?
The next day, Lizzie entered a plea of not guilty to the charges of murder and was transported by rail car to the jail in Taunton. August 22nd, I was going to say that's tomorrow.
Ooh.
Well, it's not tomorrow for you guys, but it's tomorrow for us.
Yeah.
On August 22nd, Lizzie returned to a Fall River courtroom for her preliminary hearing, at the end of which Judge Josiah Blaisdell pronounced her probably guilty and ordered her to face a grand jury and possible charges for the murder of her parents. I don't know how you can say he ordered her probably guilty.
Yeah, she's probably
maybe
guilty.
Maybe, I don't know.
Might be.
In November, so a couple months have passed now, the grand jury finally met. After first refusing to issue an indictment, the jury reconvened and heard new evidence from Alice Russell, who was a family friend who stayed with the two Borden sisters in the days after the murders. Now this is where things get a little interesting.
Now this is the part where the rap breaks down.
Russell told grand jurors that she had witnessed Lizzie Borden burning a blue dress in a kitchen fire, allegedly because, as Lizzie explained, it was covered with, quote, old paint. So that, coupled with the earlier testimony from Bridget Sullivan that Lizzie was wearing a blue dress on the morning of the murders, the evidence was enough to convince grand jurors to indict Lizzie for the murder of her parents. Also, fun fact to note, Russell's testimony was also enough to convince the Borden sisters to sever all ties with that friend forever. I can't say I would not do the same if you're going to, go on trial and accuse me of murdering my parents. Yeah, sorry.
Adios, amigo.
Sorry, we are no longer friends.
Home slice.
But that is interesting when you have that little detail of, we already thought she was wearing that blue dress and she was burning a blue dress. That's interesting. How is that coincidence? What?
I'm not saying it's coincidence, but I'm just saying.
Nick's playing devil's advocate here.
I'm not. I can't convict somebody to me on the fact that I saw her burning a blue dress. This she was true. Wearing a blue dress that day.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Okay. Now what? All right.
Plus, the difference is, I feel nowadays the way the general population is, a lot of people, are into the true crime and, kind of think investigatively, right off the bat, I'm sitting there going, she'd be covered in blood.
Yeah.
Covered.
Yeah. But maybe that's why she was burning the dress, because the dress was covered in blood.
So, the...
Yeah, she would have had to manage to get herself all... I get it. I get what you're saying.
Plus clean the whole house.
Yeah, you're right.
Without anybody noticing.
True. And there was two other people in the house at the same time besides just her. You're correct. So now, we get into the trial. And this is where, I'm just going to, try to get through this as fast as I can, because there's a lot of information. The trial of Lizzie Borden opened on June 5th, 1893, in the New Bedford Courthouse before a panel of three judges. A high-powered defense team, including Andrew Jennings and George Robinson, the former governor of Massachusetts, represented the defendant, while District Attorney Knowlton and Thomas Moody argued the case for the prosecution. The first several witnesses for the state testified concerning events in and around the Borden home on the morning of August 4th, 1892. The most important of these witnesses was Bridget Sullivan. She testified that Lizzie was the only person she saw in the home at the time that her parents were murdered. Though, she provided some consultation to the defense when she said that she had not witnessed, during her over 2 years of service to the family, signs of the rumored ugly relationship between Lizzie and her stepmother. Because they were really trying to drag it out. They were trying to make it seem like her and her stepmother absolutely hated each other. Did not speak, that whole thing. She said that everything was pleasant. Lizzie and her mother always spoke to each other, while other prosecution witnesses contradict Sullivan's assertion that all was fine between Lizzie and her stepmother. For example, Hannah H. Guilford, who made a garment for Lizzie a few months before the murders, described a conversation in which Lizzie called her stepmother a mean, good-for-nothing mother and said, "I don't have much to do with her. I stay in my room most of the time."
What?
But, like, I feel like when I was younger, like, not, I mean, she's older than me, actually. I do often forget that, like, she is, like, 30-something years old, and, like, she wasn't a kid when this happened.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like when you, I don't know, it just, she, it seems like a younger thing to me. But, like, I would get mad at my mom all the time and say silly things that, like, I don't actually mean. And, that's like, you could overhear that, and it could be taken out of context. Yep. So I feel like I'm taking this with a grain of salt here.
You have to.
Sullivan also testified that Andrew and Abby Borden experienced stomach pains on the day before the murder and told jurors that at the presumed time of Abby's murder, Lizzie claimed she was washing outside windows. Sullivan testified that she opened the door for Andrew Borden after he returned home from his walk about town, and then described hearing Lizzie's cry for help at 11 o'clock. Several witnesses described seeing Andrew Borden at various points in town in the 2 hours before he returned home to his death. So, I don't know. Things are getting a little murky here.
Yeah.
Household guest John Morse, who was 60 years old, described having breakfast in the Borden home on the morning of the murders and then leaving the house to run errands. The next set of witnesses described events and conversations after discovery of the murders. Dr. Seabury Bowen, the Borden family physician that was called to the home by Lizzie in the late morning of August 4th, recounted Lizzie's story about looking for lead sinkers in the barn and her contention that her father's troubles with his tenants probably had something to do with the murder.
Poopy landlord.
Right. On cross-examination, Seabury agreed with the defense's suggestion that the morphine he prescribed for Lizzie might account for some of the confused and contradictory testimony she gave at the inquest following the murders. So there's another thing who's like, hey, this might be a reason why she's, like, a little confused. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Adelaide Churchill, who was the Borden neighbor and another important witness, remembered Lizzie wearing a light blue dress with a diamond figure on it, but did not recall seeing any blood spots on it.
Voila.
All right. John Fleet, who was the assistant marshal of Fall River, spoke about his interview with Lizzie shortly after the murders, and Lizzie corrected him in court when he called Abby Borden her mother, which was not the smartest look on Lizzie's behalf. Like, I don't think she was trying to do it, but it's like, girl, you're already on trial for their murder. Why are you know?
But I don't know, because I get it. Like, I get.
But she snapped back at him and said, like, she's not my mother, correcting him. I know, no, because I do get it, because she is correct. That's not her mother. And then, like, she also made it a point to say, my mother died when I was a child.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like people are trying to, like, make her look worse than she was. But, yeah.
You're making a mountain out of a molehill.
Mm-hmm.
Or a mountain out of an anthill?
Molehill. That's what my mom says.
Yeah.
She's probably wrong, and we've just been going with it the whole time.
Yeah.
The most compelling testimony came again from Alice Russell. Russell described a visit from Lizzie the night before the murders, in which she said that she would soon be going on a vacation and felt that something was hanging over her. Then, according to Russell, after describing her parents' severe stomach sickness, which she attributed to bad baker's bread, Lizzie revealed that she was afraid something was going to happen. Explaining her feeling, Lizzie told Russell that she wanted to go to sleep with one eye half open half the time for fear that somebody might burn the house down or hurt her father because he was so discourteous to people. District Attorney Moody then asked Russell about the dress burning incident. Russell recounted that when she asked Lizzie what she was doing with the blue dress, she replied, "I'm going to burn this old thing up. It's covered with paint." I don't know. Like, your parents were... See, and then, like, this is why I see the other side of it. I'm like, your parents... And people grieve differently. Like, your parents were just murdered and you're worried about, like, this paint-covered dress. Like, you have to burn this paint. I get it. Things are weird after people die. Like, you do whatever you do. But I don't know. Like, I feel like I would have other things on my mind than burning this dress with paint on it.
Yeah, but didn't you say she was on, like, morphine?
True. This is true.
So maybe it was, like, a...
Yeah.
Like a weird, it's a weird response because mm-hmm. of the morphine or whatever.
Yeah. On cross-examination, defense attorney George Robinson attempted through his questions to suggest that a guilty person seeking to destroy incriminating evidence would be unlikely to do so in such an open fashion as Lizzie allegedly did, which is true. Russell also recounted a conversation with Lizzie about a note which, according to Lizzie's account, she received from a messenger on the morning of the murders, summoning her to visit a sick friend. Lizzie used the note to explain why she thought her mother had left the home and therefore didn't think to look for her body after discovering her father. So she thought that her mom, like her stepmother, just wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why she, like, because I feel like people also question that. It's like, how come the cops, like, police came and they didn't find the stepmother's body until after?
Yeah.
Lizzie didn't think she was home.
Yeah, she was...
She didn't think to look.
Yeah.
Despite a thorough search of the Borden home, the alleged note was never found. Russell said she sarcastically suggested to Lizzie that her mother might have burned the note. Lizzie, according to Russell, replied and said, yes, she must have. The defense made its case using, for the most part, the state's own witnesses. There has never been a trial so full of surprises, wrote one reporter covering the trial. With such marvelous contradictions given by witnesses called for common purpose. The defense kept hammering at the contradictory testimony of key prosecution witnesses. The defense also explored holes in the prosecution case. Like, there's just such a mess mm-hmm. everywhere. Like,
yeah.
Where the defense asked, is the handle that supposedly broke off from the axe head that the state hauled into court and claimed was part of the murder weapon? The state had no answer. Defense also exploited the government's own timeline, which allowed from 8 to 13 minutes between Andrew Borden's murder and Lizzie's call to Bridget Sullivan. Robinson tried to suggest the difficulty of washing blood off of one's person, clothes, and the murder weapon of blood, and then hiding the murder weapon all with that short span of time. So it literally would have had, mm-hmm. she would have had to get all that done in 8 to 13 minutes. And, not happening.
And the house of all the blood that you figure would be there.
Right. Like, I feel like that's just not happening. Mm-hmm. But also, what's the other option? Like, then who did that? Like, how did somebody get in and out?
It was ghost.
Right. Like, I didn't get there yet, but, like, that's crazy. The decisive moment in the trial might have come when the 3-judge panel ruled that Lizzie Borden's inquest testimony, full of contradictions and implausible claims, could not be submitted into evidence by the prosecution. The judges concluded that Lizzie, at the time of the coroner's inquest, was, for all practical purposes, a prisoner charged with 2 murders, and that her testimony at the inquest, made in the absence of her attorney, was not voluntary.
Oh.
Yeah. Lizzie should have been warned, the judges said, and that she had a right under the 5th Amendment of the Constitution to remain silent. And period.
Done.
The judges rejected the state's argument that Lizzie was only a suspect, not a prisoner, at the time of the inquest, and that, anyway, her statement should be admitted because it was in the nature of a denial rather than a confession. Regardless, you didn't read her rights, so...
Yeah, like, gotta read the rights.
Feel as if it's the first thing they teach you at the academy. Like. The prosecution rested its case on June 14th after one final defeat. The state wanted to have the druggist, Eli Bentz, recount for the jury his story of Lizzie Borden visiting the Fall River drugstore on the day before the murders and asking for 10 cents worth of prussic acid. With the jurors out of the courtroom, the state tried to establish, through medical experts, druggists, furriers, and chemists, the qualities, properties, and uses of prussic acid. The judges, after listening to the state's case, decided that the evidence should be excluded. The defense presented only a handful of witnesses. Charles Gifford and Uriah Kirby reported seeing a strange man near the Borden house around 11 o'clock on the night before the murders. Dr. Benjamin Hanfield testified that he saw a pale-faced young man on the sidewalk near 92 2nd Street around 10:30 on August 4th. A plumber and a gas filter testified that in the day or two before the murders, they had been in the Borden's barn loft, casting doubt on police assertions that Lizzie's alibi was strange or suspicious because dust in the loft appeared undisturbed. Because that was their whole thing. Mm-hmm. They were like, oh, well, no, because there's no dust disturbed. Hello? Like, I feel like there's a, like...
Yeah.
That's not that weird. Like...
Not at all.
Right. Emma Borden, the older sister of Lizzie, was the defense's most anticipated witness, obviously. Emma testified that Lizzie and her father enjoyed a good relationship. She told jurors that the gold ring found on the finger of Andrew Borden's body was given to him 10 or 15 years ago by Lizzie, and he never took it off. Emma also insisted that the relationship between Lizzie and her stepmother was cordial, even as she admitted to having resentment towards her herself. The defense had also hoped that Emma might testify that the Bordens had a custom of disposing of remnants and pieces of dresses by burning, but the court ruled the evidence as inadmissible. Summing up for the defense, A.V. Jennings argued there is not one particle of direct evidence in this case from beginning to end against Lizzie A. Borden. There's not a spot of blood. There's not a weapon that they have connected with her in any way, shape, or fashion. Following Jennings, Governor Robinson, in his closing speech for the defense, insisted that the crime must have been committed by a maniac or a devil, not by someone with the respectable background of his client. He said that the state had failed to meet its burden of providing guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and that it was physically impossible for Lizzie without the help of a partner to have committed both the crimes within the timeline suggested by the prosecution. Because, yeah, mm-hmm. like, maybe if she had a partner, okay,
yeah,
I'll give it to you. She's not getting all that done by herself in 8 to 13 minutes.
And I still, like, I think I was going to make this point earlier and I forgot. We were saying how, like, blood turns, like, darker
mm-hmm.
as it sits. You're swinging an axe. There's got to be blood on the ceiling. There's
right.
got to be blood on the ground.
Yeah.
Like, they're saying, and I think there's pictures, isn't there? I'm pretty sure there's pictures.
Unfortunately, yeah. It's, yeah.
But I'm like, I even stared at them to like focus because this all kind of just dawned on me.
Yeah.
But you would think there has to be some kind of blood spatter.
Yeah.
If there's no blood spatter or anything like that, something weird happened. There's no way within 8 to 13 minutes.
No.
You can kill somebody, clean up the whole mess, mm-hmm. clean yourself up, take a shower, get rid of all the evidence. No way.
You want to know what they tried to say she did?
What?
They tried to say that she committed the crime naked. So that she would avoid getting blood spots on her clothes. That was their theory. That she just did the whole thing. Girl.
Yeah.
What? Robinson ridiculed the theory. Argued that the murders might have well been committed by an intruder who got out of the house undetected. Because what other... Like, that's your theory? That's mm-hmm. what you're running with?
Yeah. That doesn't make any sense.
Right. The prosecution tried to expose Lizzie's narcissistic lack of emotion, claiming she didn't care about her dead parents or anyone at all. In an extremely dramatic fashion, they carted out two mysterious wood cases as the jury and Lizzie watched. Grabbing the latch, the prosecutor swung open the boxes, revealing the bashed-in skulls of Andrew and Abby Borden.
Oh, boy.
Could you imagine? Like, you're already on trial for a murder that, like, I don't think she committed, mm-hmm. but, like... And then they wheel in the literal skulls of, like, your dead parent. I'm like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
That would... I'd have a...
Well...
I'd twitch or something.
They saw her reaction as cold and unemotional. No, I feel like that's shock. Like, I would mm-hmm. be in shock.
But again,
shock.
Back then, they probably didn't understand shock.
True. True. Well, it actually may have been the moment that marked Lizzie as an innocent woman. As when she saw the skulls of her deceased parents, she screamed, stood up, and fainted. It wasn't long after the jury came back with their verdict. The jury deliberated for an hour and a half before returning with its verdict. The clerk asked the foreman of the jury? We're going on a journey.
Mm-hmm.
The clerk asked the foreman of the jury, what is your verdict? And he replied, not guilty. Lizzie let out a yell, sank into her chair, rested her hands on a courtroom rail, put her face in her hands, and then let out a second cry of joy. Emma, her counsel, and the courtroom speculators were rushing to congratulate Lizzie. She hid her face in her sister's arms and said, now take me home. I want to go to the old place, and I want to go at once tonight. Now we get into the aftermath of all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Papers generally praised the jury's verdict. The New York Times, for example, editorialized that it will be a certain relief to every right-minded man or woman who has followed the case to learn that the jury at New Bedford has not only acquitted Miss Lizzie Borden of the atrocious crime with which she was charged, but has done so with a promptness that was very significant. The Times added, considered the verdict a condemnation of the police authorities of Fall River who secured the indictment and have conducted the trial. Not stopping there, the Times editor blasted the vitriol of ignorant and untrained men charged with the detection of crime in smaller cities, the police in Fall River. The editor concluded, are the usual inept and stupid and muddle-headed sort that such towns manage to get for themselves. So he was pissed. To make a long story short, he was pissed.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. To me, I feel like it's just like, again, you go back then where police work was and stuff, they just didn't.
Right.
These guys probably just wanted to close the case. Yeah. Like, oh, we're done.
Get it done.
But at the same time, I don't know. I don't know how 1930s police work worked, you know?
I think in my opinion, it's probably fair to say, however likely it may be that she did murder her parents, whatever you think, the prosecution failed to meet its burden of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. They just didn't do that. So whether she did it or not, they couldn't prove it.
Mm-hmm.
Had Lizzie been a male, some speculate that the jury might have been more inclined to convict. One of the defense's great advantages was that most people in 1893 found it hard to believe that a woman of Lizzie's background could have pulled off such brutal killing. Which is crazy that they literally didn't even think that she had enough... Well, I do get it. It would have been, like I said, a lot of work and all that, but like...
Yeah, because I
mean... Don't say women don't have the heart. I feel like they could have gotten it done.
No, but I think, you know, they're saying back then...
Yeah.
I mean, even now, like, the technology and the study that we have of it now, her size versus her dad's size, like, the axe swings and everything, like, the angles and stuff, and, like, the force that you would need to do that, she probably wasn't capable of getting that.
Right.
But back then, they didn't.
Yeah.
You're not going to do that. You're not going to, you're just going to, two people in the house, you were in that room, you found them, you're guilty.
Mm-hmm.
My thing's, where's the axe?
Right.
If you can't find this, so what did she do? How did she hide this axe from the time she killed them to the time she told everybody? Right. Where did it go?
I guess we'll never know.
Yeah.
After the trial, Lizzie Borden returned to Fall River, where she and her sister Emma purchased an impressive home on the hill, which they called Maplecroft. Lizzie took an interest in theater, frequently attending plays and often associating with actors, artists, and bohemian type. Emma moved out of Maplecroft in 1905. Lizzie continued to live there until her death at age 67 in 1927. She was buried by the graves of her parents in Fall River's Oak Grove Cemetery. Okay, so now that you know the entire story and what happened, you're of course entitled to form your own opinion on whether or not you think she's guilty. But I feel the one thing that is extremely hard to argue is that the Lizzie Borden house is haunted.
Oh, of course, it's gotta be. There's no way it's not.
For sure. So let's start with the ghost of Abby Borden. The Lizzie Borden house is now currently an infamous bed and breakfast, which I love that that's what they did with it.
Oh, yeah.
You can sleep in the room where Abby was murdered and have tea where they found Andrew. Simply dark tourism at its best.
Oh, that's probably the best.
Yeah. Many times, an older woman is seen wandering the house. Some guests think it's a maid or the host of the bed and breakfast getting up to greet the women. They find themselves alone. It's most definitely Abby. Going about her chores just before walking into the guest room to meet up with her stepdaughter and a hatchet.
Mm-hmm.
Abby's mostly seen in the second floor hallway and guest room. Visitors sleeping in that room have felt the bedsheets tighten around them, then hear brushing as if hands sliding across the covers, with a slight pressure against their chest and legs. Abby meticulously straightening the fabric, calmly making the bed, that sort of thing. If that isn't enough to convince you, of course the ghost of Miss Lizzie herself has been sighted. Duh.
Why wouldn't she?
Guess.
Still proving her innocence.
Yeah, she's got to. She said, I'm staying around, okay? Guests staying in the room beside her is wake at night. It's subtle, but undeniable. The sound of a woman crying on the other side of the wall. Reported to the hosts many times. Every year, on the anniversary of the murder, the bread and breakfast does a reenactment. Not of the murders, but of the maybe half an hour or so after the murders. Visitors can come in and interview the people in the house and try and solve the case while two actors lie under blankets and literally play dead. Which is most definitely morbid, but I think that's kind of cool. All the rooms in the house are named after whoever stayed in them, like the John Morse room or the Andrew and Abby suite. The house's previous owner once decided to spend a night in Bridget's room only to find that a rocking chair that had been across the room when she fell asleep was now sitting next to her bed when she awoke, and it was rocking.
They always got to.
Yeah.
Rocking chair. Be a rocking if you get chair. A rocking chair, it's going to rock.
Yeah, it's going to move when
at
nobody's in it.
At some point, it's going to rock you're and nobody's going to be it. There.
A ton of people online who have visited the bed and breakfast highly recommend the fascinating daytime tours of the house. You get a comprehensive overview of what happened that day, and you'll also get to see the very places that the murders took place, including the upstairs guest room, where Lizzie's stepmother was struck down while making a bed. You'll also see a replica of the couch where Mr. Borden laid down to take a lunchtime nap, and, well, you know what happened after that. That sounds something more like my speed, a nice little daytime tour, no sleeping in the house.
Why not?
I don't think I would sleep in the Lizzie Borden house. Fully. I know, like, people have recorded podcast episodes in the Lizzie Borden house.
Wait, oh, Morbid did.
They did.
Theirs was pretty good.
It was great.
Yeah.
I don't think I have the balls for that.
Then I think they did theirs, too, and it was a storm.
Wouldn't... Yeah, I think you're right, actually. I think it was. Yeah, that is crazy to me. I give them so much props.
Yeah.
I simply don't even think... Like, the hauntedness aside, like, I feel like there's just so much darkness and, like, not good energy in that house. Like...
Boy, are you going to be excited for our big reveal.
I know. Other Lizzie-related places in Fall River include the cemetery, where she lies buried beside the parents that she supposedly murdered, and then Maplecroft, which is the Victorian mansion where she spent her final years. At the Fall River Historical Society, there's an entire room of Lizzie memorabilia, including a bloody pillow sham and a hairpiece that flew off Mrs. Borden's head as she was being struck. And so, for a lack of anything but circumstantial evidence, there are two things we'll never know for certain. One, did Lizzie do it? And two, if she didn't, who did?
Yeah.
Like, perhaps a third person just crept into the house, or I don't know what.
Maniac with an axe?
Yeah.
There's something about the 1930s and axes.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's, like, more than one... I don't want to say famous, but there was, like, more than one true crime, like, with the Lizzie Borden, and there's, like, a few other, like, axe murders.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Phil Devitt, a tour guide at the house, summed it all up. People usually leave the house with more questions than when they walked in. That's a sign that we've done our job. Even with all the facts of what we know happened, we can't piece together an answer that's going to satisfy everyone. That's the frustration that lies behind the Lizzie Borden story. This case is certainly stuck in pop culture. There's so many different works of film, theater, and literature inspired by the case. Shit, it's literally 2025. This case is 132 years old, and we're still talking about it.
Yeah.
So now that I gave you all that, I have a question for you.
For me?
Yeah, for you.
Woo!
Do you think that she murdered her parents?
No. Nope.
Do you think that the house is haunted?
Yes.
Would you ever stay at the Lizzie
Yes.
And you know what's funny?
Give me a hard one.
When I wrote all these questions, I was like, I know his answers, but I'm just going to put them in here anyway. Yeah. That wraps it up for me and the Lizzie Borden house. I hope you guys enjoyed this one. I know it was a lot of, like, kind of like legal talk. I talked about the case for a little bit, but I feel like I have to. Like, you need to know the
you
stuff.
Yeah, you got to kind of get the background
you
and
need
stuff
to know
like
the
that.
Info.
I think it was good, and I think it was a step more in the spooky season.
A little spooky.
Yeah, a little deeper than last week with the ghosts
spooky.
Of Broadway.
Yes.
So... I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. I don't think she killed her parents.
I also don't think she killed her parents.
I don't... I mean, the only...
But the question really does remain to me, then, who the hell has gotten away with that for 32 years, or 132 years?
I think if we went back in time, what you're going to find is the timing of their saying things.
Mm-hmm.
If she did it,
yeah,
the timing that they're saying things is off. It wasn't 8 to 13 minutes... And
but the whole thing was that the maid remembered specifically, like, looking at the time and knowing it was 11 o'clock on the dot.
Yeah.
Like, she vivid, like, that's not something that you're going to mistake. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't know. I think that my girl just got the shitty luck of the draw.
Yeah. I mean, because, or the murders happened and that's, like... They were found at that time, but, like, their time of death is off.
Well, true, because I could see that being a thing, because, God, all the stuff that we have now compared to, like, what they had back then to tell, like, that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think now they do, like, liver temperature and stuff, but back then they probably didn't do that.
Right.
And were they dead for longer?
Yeah.
You know, and it was hot.
True.
It was August, so you said a hot August day.
Mm-hmm.
Did somebody come in and kill them and, like... kind of clean up, like, that's what kills me.
Yeah,
where is the
rest of the evidence?
Yes, where to go?
Yeah,
there's no axe,
right.
Hatchet, whatever you want to say. They don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to look at the picture, or like maybe I guess go like a little deeper into the crime documents or whatever.
Yeah.
Were there blood spatter, blood right. stains, anything? And things back then too, people would walk into the house while yeah. the police were doing the investigation.
Yeah.
Who's to say that the murder weapon wasn't there, but mm-hmm. somebody else took it?
Yeah. True.
So,
seriously, they didn't have that stuff on lock back then.
I don't know, but I don't think she did it.
I don't think she did it either.
I know people can do, like, you know, they have some kind of, like, mental disorder or something yeah. where they can kind of, like, separate and, like, become another person, mm-hmm. sort of. And yeah.
Like, multiple personality type thing.
Yeah, and, like, have extra strength and stuff like that they
True.
Wouldn't normally.
But I feel like even still that's a reach.
I feel like she would have, there would be other scenarios and stuff like that where they'd yeah. be like, oh.
Well, this was a little weird. Like, I remember this happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or, like, her sister would be like, oh, yeah, like, sometimes she's not, you know, she's just is different.
Right. Like, her sister was mm-hmm. standing by her, and yeah. her parents were also just murdered.
Yeah.
I feel like that's also very telling.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like it's just a good one. Makes you think.
It is. It's a good one to talk about. Fun one to talk about.
Hope it made you guys think.
Gives you a place to kind of go and visit if you want.
Yeah.
In Massachusetts.
It's definitely...
After that, swing by, oh no, that's Connecticut. I was going to say swing by the, Stars Hollow.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, you could.
They're not that they're far.
Not that far from part. But anyway. So if you enjoyed the episode, don't forget to like us, follow. We're really bad at saying this stuff in the beginning. Comment, rate us. It helps us reach more people. It also kind of gives us a guide on how we're doing. If you want to email us, you can email us at ominousarchives@gmail.com. As always, special thanks to Sam for all the hard work that she does. Go check her out at scaremesam.com. Or if you want to check her podcast out, if you're in the market for a new book, check her podcast out, Scare Me Sam. And with that being said, don't forget to check back next week as we dive into more strange and haunted stories here in the Ominous Archives. See ya.
See ya.